Good morning. Is this us? This is us. All right. Hi, everyone. So this morning, I'm going to talk with you about a fairy tale, because it's a holiday weekend, you guys. And we should all be getting time and a half, don't you think? For being at Zen Center on holiday weekend, time and a half. Don't you think? Seems fair, right? This room is trouble already. Already we're off the leash. So on the front of your program this morning is my entry point. I'm not going to say too much about it, but I think it's a lovely way of starting to talk about this fairy tale. And it is from, it's a short passage that I thought we would read together. So if you have it in front of you, you can recite it with me. And if you don't, you can look on with your neighbor or just listen. It is from one of my very favorite koan collections. It is not a formal koan in that it is not from the Zen tradition, but it's from a Gnostic gospel found in Nag Hammadi in the 50s called the Gospel of Thomas. And it's a book that's just a collection of short, very, very short, either anecdotal pieces or quotes that are spiritual teachings. So there's no narrative arc, there's no cast of characters, there's no setting or anything like that. It's just a collection of kind of one-offs. And so in that way, it reads very much like a koan collection in our Zen tradition. They're just isolated conversations or isolated sentences or isolated moments that we're supposed to kind of sit with as we would with a koan and put them in our body and sort of see what they teach us, right? So let's read this together and see how that sounds, shall we? If you bring forth that which is within you, then that which is within you will be your salvation. If you do not bring forth that which is within you, then that which is within you will destroy you. There's a lot there. That sounds a lot like Zen to me. If you don't know what's down there, you're in trouble. And if you do know what's down there, enlightenment, freedom, salvation, joy. So I'm going to talk about a fairy tale, but I want to get there via a very short narrative about my life. When I was four, I'm going to say four because the last time I gave this talk an hour and a half ago, I landed on four. So when I was four, my father was transferred to Sweden for work, and he was going to be there between 4 and 6 months, which is what it ended up being. And that's a long enough time that he thought it prudent to bring along his wife and his two children. And so we lived in a little town. Well, it's probably huge now. I don't know. It was little then. Called Linköping, that's outside of Stockholm in Sweden. So we lived in Sweden for about 6 months. The only reason that's relevant to me is because that's about the age I started to form memories. I don't know about you. Some folks can remember way farther back than four. Some people don't remember anything before eight. It kind of just depends. But some of my earliest cognitive memories, meaning a memory that has a picture or a story or some sense of place along with it, were of living in Sweden and traveling around Scandinavia when I was really, really young. So I'm starting by saying that because I think my relationship with the story I'm going to talk to you guys about was formed by a very initial pre-egoic impression of something. You know, we kind of develop sense of self and personality and right and wrong and all the things we kind of call our ego construct for most of us in this culture, you know, about 5, you gotta go to school and you gotta be on time. And there's, you know, the apple getting colored red and the grasshopper getting colored green, and you're right and wrong and sit up straight. And you know what I mean? You start to kind of assemble a sense of self, persona and shadow. You know, oh no, we don't say that. Oh, okay, we think it, right? Yeah, but you just don't say it. So you start, you know, you start developing the splits, all the little splits that make us the complicated, wonderful little beings we are, right? So at 4, I'm imagining myself being, I'm starting to get formed already by right and wrong and what makes me a good boy, what makes me a bad boy. But those early impressions tend to go in pretty deep. They can kind of be formative and be kind of operating on some level in your psyche. So when we lived in Stockholm, we visited a very famous cathedral, which I will not try to pronounce because I'm kind. My pronunciation would be wildly inaccurate, but it translates into English as St. George's Cathedral, and if you Google St. George's Cathedral, Stockholm, you will find it. It is very famous, and it's was famous for a bunch of reasons, political and religious, but its centerpiece, the jewel in the crown of St. George's Cathedral in Stockholm, is a very dramatic and gorgeously rendered wooden statue from 1489 of St. George and the Dragon. Does everybody know St. George and the Dragon? Okay. If you don't know St. George and the Dragon, it's what you imagine St. George and the Dragon is going to be. Bad dragon, good knight. There, that's the story. Okay? So there's the story. So I'm a little kid, and we're visiting this famous place, and I'm old enough to at least understand that I'm in a special place. Because, you know, churches are different than grocery stores. You know, when you, even as a very young being, you walk into a place that's designed to be special, and you kind of have a sense of that. And the way the space is arranged, this is very clearly the centerpiece of one of the areas of the church. And the base of, it's a huge statue. Again, I'm a 4-year-old, you guys. So maybe it's not big at all. But back then it was big. The base of the statue holds relics of saints who came after, you know, heads and bones and fingers and that kind of stuff. Relics of holy people. So it's a big deal. This thing's a big deal. And the image, and if you look online, you'll see it, but it's the kind of image you probably have in your head. Here we have St. George in his armor atop his steed with a very, I forget if he has a sword or a lance, but he has his weapon. And the dragon is already beaten into submission and is, that's the moment frozen in time. It's about to get pierced, right? So symbolically, of course, this is the triumph of good over evil. It's the triumph of good over evil. And in our culture, meaning in this particular case, Western culture, the dragon icon, the dragon archetype, is an image of greed, right? In our myths, the dragon is a hateful figure, and the dragon is fundamentally fueled by all that we resist about ourselves. So to put this in Buddhist terms, the dragon is greed, hate, and delusion. The origin of suffering, right? Greed, hate, and delusion. Because you know dragons, right? They're always collecting gold that they can't use. Like, what are you going to do with that? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Shut up. Rah, fire. And, you know, stealing kids and eating people and capturing virgins and all this stuff it has no need for whatsoever. But it's by virtue of its nature, it's greedy and it's hateful and it's deluded. So it just does greedy, hateful, deluded things. It's like it's dragon doing dragon job. It's its job, right? So from a Buddhist perspective, greed, hate, and delusion, it's the universal affliction. There are 8 billion of us now on this planet who have a relationship with greed, hate, and delusion. Suffering. We all have a relationship with what we call suffering. What we call constriction, resistance, pain. And what causes that pain, Al, in the Buddhist worldview, all of the many, many myriad variations on greed and hate and delusion. Fundamentally misunderstanding what it is to be alive, what this is, and becoming greedy and hateful as a result of that. It's the universal condition. So, back to four-year-old me. What I remember about this, aside from this is a special place and I'm being shown something that's important, was I was also at least dimly aware of how I was expected to respond to the image. I didn't know that. I didn't remember that until I started writing this talk. But it's funny the way memory... Isn't it funny the way memory works? Like, if you really spend a lot of time unpacking a particular memory, all sorts of other layers that were there, isn't that wild? So I'm actually remembering, knowing, I know how I'm supposed to respond to this. I'm supposed to think, all right, St. George is the dude. I mean, right, he's purity and virtue and shining armor and strength, you know, and he's got his friggin' lance and, oh, yeah, man, stick it to the dragon. I mean, that's the, it's design, it's an object of worship. It's supposed to arouse in us feelings of devotional identification with virtue and truth and righteousness. I mean, that's its function, right, as an art object, one would argue. And what I remember was, and it's funny that I remember this, being out of sync. Because I knew, this is how I'm supposed to be responding to this, you know. I'm supposed to think, wow, I want to be like St. George someday. What I remember feeling instead was, oh, the dragon. Oh, no. Because in about 3 seconds, this statue is going to look way different, and there'll be this dead animal, and that, you know, so I felt out of sync. Very, very early memory of feeling out of sync. Isn't that interesting? So there's where we're starting today. I didn't think much about this afterwards, because, you know, I'm a four-year-old, and blah, I didn't think much about anything for a long time. I hope that's universal. I hope you guys are laughing with me. Oh, dear, I'd forgotten all about it until many, many years later, the Lord of the Rings, right? The Lord of the Rings. I'm introduced to the Lord of the Rings, you know, and the Hobbit and the Fellowship of the Ring, and there's this great character, Smaug, of course, the great dragon, and the one vulnerable piece in his armor, the one piece that's missing is, of course, where you need to shoot the arrow to pierce his heart and kill him. Oh, here's the same idea again. Here's the same archetype showing up again. And again, even though I was a lot older, I was like, oh no, maybe there's a way that, maybe they could do something else with Smaug. Like, maybe he could breathe fire and power a generator, or maybe, I don't know. Come on, man. Just shooting stuff. I don't know. I'm not claiming to be a sophisticated four-year-old, by the way, or a sophisticated teenager. This is just the way that my heart kind of arranges itself around this stuff. So when we fast forward a few more years, we come to me being a student at the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center and reading a book that was new at the time called After the Ecstasy, The Laundry by Jack Kornfield. Some of you have read this book. Yes, I see pause. I know a lot of you are very familiar with it. After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, it's one of my faves. I will confess to you, it's not strictly speaking a Zen book, but I really love the way he outlines kind of the big milestones and the guideposts on the spiritual path. And he pulls in stories and images and reflections from lots of different traditions. And one of the stories he tells in that book, Jack Kornfield is an American Zen, American Buddhist teacher, if you don't know. It's Kornfield. And we used a couple of his books for practice periods years ago. So what he tells is a dragon story that has the same kind of starting relationship with dragon energy as I've just described. But it's a metaphor, the way he uses it is it's a metaphor for a different way of relating to this energy. And I found his summation of the fairy tale really, really helpful. And so that's what I want to talk about today. And I'm just going to quote him directly. I'm going to read right from his book. So this is Jack Kornfield. Wrapping his own words around this this legend, and I think it's from Scandinavia, and I don't know if it was Finland or Iceland or Norway or Sweden, but it's quite old, and it's called The Dragon and the Princess. Because of the mishaps of her parents, a young princess named Aris must be betrothed to a fearful dragon. When the king and queen tell her she becomes frightened for her life. But recovering her wits, she goes out beyond the market to seek a wise woman who has raised 12 children and 29 grandchildren and who knows the ways of dragons and men. The wise woman tells Eris she must indeed marry the dragon, but that there are proper ways to approach him. She then gives instructions for the wedding night. In particular, the princess is bidden to wear 10 beautiful gowns, one on top of the other. The wedding takes place. A feast is held in the palace, after which the dragon carries the princess off to his bedchamber. When the dragon advances toward his new bride, she stops him, saying that she must carefully remove her wedding attire before offering her heart to him. And he too, she adds, as instructed by the wise woman, must properly remove his attire. And to this he willingly agrees. As I take off each layer of my gown, you must also remove a layer. Then, taking off the first gown, the princess watches as the dragon sheds his outer layer of scaly armor. Though it is painful, the dragon has done this periodically before. But then the princess removes another gown, and then another. And each time the dragon finds he too must claw off a deeper layer of scales. By the fifth gown, the dragon begins to weep, copious tears at the pain. And yet the princess continues. With each successive layer, the dragon's skin becomes more tender, and his form softens. He becomes lighter and lighter. When the princess removes her 10th and final gown, the dragon releases the last vestige of dragon form and emerges as a man, a fine prince, whose eyes sparkle like a child's, released at last from the ancient spell of his dragon form. Princess Eris and her new husband are now left to the pleasures of the bridal chamber. So I thank Jack Kornfield for introducing me to this. I am not a folklore or legend scholar. I likely would never have come across an arcane Scandinavian fairy tale like this, but boy, there is so much here. There is so much here. I've thought about it on some level ever since I first read it here at Zen Center, you know, 8 years ago or whatever. So I want to talk about it. I want to break it down a little bit, some of the stuff that moved me about it. But as with all Dharma conversations, I encourage you to have your own relationship with the material. This thing is easy to find online. Find it, read it, spend a little time noticing what your heart does in response to various pieces, and why. Your karma is different than mine, so something's going to come alive for you, you know, that I don't notice, and something's alive for you that, for me, that doesn't resonate with you. So I encourage you to do that. I'm going to talk about some of the phrases in it. but, you know, I was watching a TV show last night, and I stopped it. I put it on pause so I could write. I have these little notepads all over my house, and I'm always driving my wife crazy by going, can we stop the movie right now? I've got to write something down. Oh, man. Is this about the talk? Yeah, but it's going to be so good. So I'm watching the second to the last episode of Street Food, this show on Netflix, Street Food, right? It's great. Little half-hour episodes of these famous but all but anonymous outside of their culture little street food vendors from all over the world. It's just fantastic. And I watched, I was really moved by this guy. He's a noodle maker. He makes wonton noodles in Singapore. Master Tang. And in the closing credits, it said, this episode is in memory of Master Tang. He died after they shot it, you know. So he's a noodle maker. That's what he does. He makes noodles. And he makes it the way his dad's dad, whatever, you know, the ancient spell of noodle making. He's doing it the same way they've always done it. And at one point he says, if you ask me, why is it so hard to make your noodles? I would say it's because you're doing it right. And I went,
yeah, baby.
You know, it's day three of your five-day meditation retreat, and you go on the sign-up sheet to go talk to whoever's leading that retreat, and you're like, why is it so hard? Oh, you're doing it right. How come when I get down to, like, layer three of my armor, it starts hurting so much? You're doing it right. You know? Wow, isn't that cool? I think that's encouraging. I experience that as encouraging because of how often it's difficult for me. And to reframe that as a sign of doing something correctly, as opposed to, right, a sign that I'm doing something wrong, is deeply helpful to me. Because, boy, this is a really easy room to spend time in if you want it to be. If you really, really want to, after John rings the bell, you got 30 minutes, you can make that a really easy 30 minutes. You can close your eyes and you can leave. And you can go to a really pleasant place. If you want, you can. I mean, just drift off. Trip out. Trance out. Do next week's shopping list. Review your favorite movie. Yep, Princess Bride again. Cue it up. You get to do that. Remind yourself of all things that are right. Ignore all the stuff that hurts. You can totally do that. We do it all the time here. Everybody does. It can all be bypassed if you want it to be. And there are times when I actually think that's skillful. There are times when the heart that we bring to the Zendo is so afflicted and in so much pain that giving it some space and some comfort and some tenderness and some reassurance is kind. It's the activity of compassion. But we don't need too much of that. We're grown-ups. You're at a Zen center. You're already a grown-up. You're already tough enough to be here or you wouldn't be here. So the invitation is something else. Yeah, you can make noodles the easy way. But there is something else. Why do the waves keep coming? Why? There's something under there, isn't there? And now practice starts to change. Right? We're calling upon something deeper about ourselves. We don't need to underestimate Buddha. Right? Isn't that cool? Because Buddha's hardcore, right? It's you. You're hardcore. You wouldn't be here if you weren't hardcore. Right? You keep showing up. You keep looking. There's something under there. And there's something under that. And there's something under that. And there's something under that. Right? Wow, it changes our relationship. Why is it so hard? Because you're doing it right. You're brave enough to dig. That's what we're doing in archaeology here, right? All the way down to the bottom, all the way down to the bottom, till we get to the place where there's no separation anymore. But we don't do that by avoiding the work. We do that by doing the work. So there's a very different relationship that we're welcomed into. And Jack Kornfield riffed on this in his own way in the book. He loved this metaphor of the dragon needing to peel away, peel away, peel away till it gets down to the tender, clear-eyed, beautiful human being, you know? What speaks to me about this and my starting place here in talking about the lovely fairy tale is that the bride and the dragon are the same person. Okay, they're you. You're the bride. You're the dragon. Ta-da! That hopefully simplifies everything, right? These stories are always internally focused. We always think they're external. They're never external, ever. Who cares about external? It's internal, 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 right? And if you really had a lot of time and you can't think of anything else better to do a Sunday on Memorial Day weekend, write down scale, dragon, parents, veil, princess, and unpack each one of those things. What are they about for you? All those things live in you. They're all symbols of something that's alive in you, right? That's all about you. So here we have an idea. I talked about it last time I gave a talk, like a month ago. We talked about the Golden Buddha. The Golden Buddha, right? This preeminent idea in Mahayana Buddhism that at the core of a human being is Buddha. It's awakeness. Awakeness. It's not something you can even move toward because you are it. It's the thing that's looking. It's you. It's awakeness. It's fundamentally loving. It's fundamentally wise. It's fundamentally compassionate. It's all of the iconography. All of those things are referring to you. That's you. That's who you actually are way at bottom, right? That's who you actually are. There's no place to go. You are it. And yet we don't know that we are it. We forget that we are it. We have needed to cover that. We've needed to cover that with defense, personality, show up on time, sit up straight. We need to do that. It's part of our socialization. We need to do that. Right? No enemies here. We need to do that. But of course, at some point, just like in the story, we forget that there was a thing before the showing up on time and sitting up straight, that there was something before that. And so we need to be reminded. And meditation practice becomes a remember Buddha? Go back to that. And how do you get there? By going through each of the successive layers of the you and shining the light on that successive layer and holding the pain of that successive layer with great tenderness and great compassion and speaking the truth to it. You are wisdom. You are compassion. Do you see we're beginning to be identified with the liberative energy itself, the activity of Buddha, right? Wow! So the princess who's pure and the dragon who's one person. I hope everybody here knows that about themselves. Please get to know both of those energies in you. Please don't forget that they're both part of you. Because our job is to love both of those back into unity, right? So here's some of the significant things that showed up for me around this story. And every time I read it, I get something different. But for the sake of today, here's what I got. I'm going to start with Aris, her name, A-R-I-S. Again, I don't know what language this was written, so I'm making a bit of a jump. But when I looked that up, it said, oh yeah, that usually translates as Lion of God. I went, oh yeah, oh, that's a rock star name, man, Lion of God. Right, the lion, right? Aslan, the symbol of wide awake, giant-hearted consciousness, right? Christ consciousness, Buddha consciousness, awake consciousness. You know, when you go meet with the Zen teacher, they're like, are you going to go pull the lion's whiskers? You know, because you're sitting down opposite a lion. It's loving, but it's, you know, not kidding. What I like about that is it's easy for us, especially in this culture, to imagine the princess, oh, she's little and she's feminine, she's diminutive, and she's like, oh, no, 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 no. She was just told by a very wise woman who knows the ways of dragons and men, oh, you can totally go in there with that dragon. You can totally do that. Get in there, kiddo. Right? That's not arguing for her limitation. That's arguing for her strength. Yes, you can marry the dragon. That conversation I can imagine going on for quite a long time because I'm over-identifying the air. Air's going, are you sure? I'm pretty sure there's probably a way that we could sneak. I mean, couldn't we? I don't want to do it. Fierce, right? Fierce, strong, loyal. The second thing that struck me about this story is the phrase, because of the mishaps of her parents. Isn't that great? Because of the mishaps of her parents. So Western psychology I love that sentence, because of the mishaps. I love it for a bunch of reasons. It's not her choice. She didn't ask for this. She did not sign up for this. I'm going to grow up and marry a dragon. Nope. Doesn't show up a lot. Not interested. I have to marry a dragon? That's a lot more believable story, right? Because of the mishaps of her parents. So she doesn't choose, and of course at some point she does choose, and it becomes her choice. But because of the mishaps of her parents, where that takes me as a Zen practitioner is all my ancient twisted karma. All my ancient twisted karma. In this story, the phrase is the ancient spell. Because of the ancient spell, you're a dragon. That's why. That's a pretty good reason. Because of the ancient spell. This is dukkha. This is dukkha. It's the thing that happens. The missing the mark that everybody does. What I love about the way we talk about this in our tradition is that this is universal. It isn't because of your personal failing. It's because it's universal. It's universal. It's the mishaps of our parents, our literal parents, our figurative parents, our spiritual parents, our emotional parents, our physical parents, our biological parents. Every human who is ever born gets all of it. And I know your particular karma is slightly different than my particular karma because of eye color and genetic predisposition and country of origin, blah, 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 blah. And that is true, and we are different in that way. And when we follow that back far enough, far enough, far enough, we go, oh, I get it. I inherited all of this, just like everybody did. Everybody inherited all of it. We can't fail to inherit all of it. All of the joy, all of the suffering, all of the karma. We inherit Buddha. We inherit Hitler. We all inherit all of it because of the mishaps of our parents. Did any of us sign up for this? Right? Only once you're born, you're like, oh, oh, man, it's too late. I don't know if you signed up for that or not. I've talked to people who claim they remember choosing. Okay, that's cool. I do not have that memory. My first memory is being four in a weird cathedral with somebody about to get stabbed to death. Right? We all inherit all of it because of the mishaps of our parents. Wow. So she has to seek out somebody wise, and she is wise enough to seek out somebody wise. So right away I'm like, yeah, already, you got it, kid, because you're smart enough to know, oh, I don't know how to do it with this one, so I'm going to go talk to somebody who's smart. She does not go to her parents, you'll notice, because they've already set things up pretty good, right? They say you got to go marry the dragon. So she goes out to the wise woman, and where does the wise woman live? Where all wise women live, out beyond the market. Right? Where does the Zen master live? Out beyond the market. It's like, oh, take three left, it's in the same strip mall as Super America. Nope. They're always, right, symbolically, even if they are in the strip mall, they are symbolically outside of the marketplace, outside of the realm of the ego, right? There she finds our source of wisdom. And at the beginning, of course, that source of wisdom is external to her. By the end of the story, she becomes it. But at the beginning of the story, the source is external. Of course it is, right? That's why we have a Zen teacher. That's why we read scripture. That's why we listen to talks and read books from other voices outside of us. We begin to resonate and feel it in, and slowly but surely we begin to realize I and thou. That's one thing. So out beyond the market. I don't know why this description moves me so much, but I just love that the wise woman is wise because she's had 12 children, 29 grandchildren, and she knows the ways of dragons and men. Don't you just right away like, oh man, I want to hang out with you. You just know stuff, right? Your hands are dirty. You know the deal. She knows the ways of dragons and men. Are they even two different things? I don't think so. She knows the deal. So she's, what's implied is she's wise because of experience. That's all. It's that simple. We all get that one. She's been there. So when Aris comes and goes, oh my God, they're making me marry a dragon, she'd be like, oh yeah, sure. That's what you do. Ain't no thing. She knows the ways. So here's the part of the story that you expect, at least that I expected to go differently. I expect the wise woman to give her an out. Take the pill, cast this potion, get on the back of this cool horse or whatever the thing is, and you're going to get away from this fate. Right? You're going to escape from it. That's kind of what I would expect at this point in the movie, right? And instead, the wise woman tells her the very same thing her parents do, which is, yeah, you have to marry the dragon. I think that's interesting. I think that's interesting. In my imagination, she's got two sets of people telling her she's got to marry a dragon. One is mom and dad because of their mishaps. And one is a wise woman saying, oh yeah, you do have to. But when I'm reading this story, those two things feel different to me. The wise woman who says, oh yes, you do. I'm imagining her with a big smile on her face like, oh, you have no idea. This is good. It's going to be wild. But I'm going back to my, you're the lion of God. Like, you can totally do this. The first version is you're about to be a victim. And the second one is, oh, no, no. No, I'm going to set you up. You're going to figure this out. This whole thing is going to be transformed because of what you are about to do. Does that make sense? The wise woman doesn't go in her place. She says, here's what you need to do, and you can go do it. She empowers this. Right? Isn't that cool? Sure, you can marry the dragon. Don't worry about it. It's going to be different than what you think. She doesn't give away the ending. By the way, it's a prince. He's super hot. She doesn't give away the ending. She says, you will, in fact, marry the dragon. Because the truth is, she's got to marry a dragon, right? She doesn't know the end bit yet. Right? Wow. But, so she's not allowing her escape. But she does say, but there are ways to approach the dragon. And that's what I'm going to teach you. Here's where the connection to Zen stops being in any way abstract. Because every single time over the many years that I have been here, that I have taken my suffering upstairs, and I have offered it to Susan or Tim or Ted in Dokusan, and said some variation on, I hurt, and it's not stopping. Never once have they said, here's how you escape from it. Right? Never once have they said, I have a fast steed outside in the backyard, and you should just get on and ride and never look back. Never. Never have they done that, right? Thank goodness they loved me enough to say, oh, I know what you need to do. You're going to go down and marry the dragon. You're going to go right back down there into that Zendo. But I'll offer you something that might be of help. Right? Does that make sense? It's never about escape. And the other thing that they never, ever, 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 ever did is they never gave me a weapon. You guys, they never gave me a weapon. that never said the dragon is your enemy and it needs to end. And this thing needs to die, or be amputated, or be defeated, or be crushed, or be covered, ever. Never once did they do that for me. They said, no, you just have to know how to be in relationship with this. Because they were wise enough to go, and they were wise enough to not tell me this, you're the dragon. Don't worry about it, sweetie. We'll teach you this thing. It's going to be okay. Right? They know the end. But they just give me the next step because they're kind. So they did the very same thing with me that the wise woman does with this, with our hero here, right? You can do with this. The other thing here, because now we're going to switch from Eris a little bit to the dragon part, because we are both, right? We really are all both. On the dragon side of things, we learn some things actually about him. And the first thing we learn actually is he has periodically removed his scales before. Isn't that an interesting detail that they put in? Like, you know, he takes off first, he's like, it's not that big of a deal. I've done this every once in a while. You're like, really? Why would you mention that? That seems like a funny sort of thing, like a snake. Like, I got to shed my skin. Oh, yeah, right, snakes do that. Yeah, it's a normal snaky thing, right? So, you know, dragons are just big snakes. He's just taking off periodically before, and I went, oh, I know why, because here's this metaphor for our ego armoring. Here's this metaphor for all the defenses we have to wear against each other. And, yeah, you know what? We do take them off periodically now that I think about it. Periodically something crazy happens, like you fall in love. And you want to armor up, and you can't. Nope, they're coming in. Oh, God, just got to be cool and suave. Oh, yeah, that's going to work great. No, you can't be cool and suave, dude. You're in love. You're going to act like an idiot, and they're going to love you anyway, and then you're going to get what's going on, right? Because love is not a dance of defense. It's not two people's armor that match. It's two princesses. Do you get it? We're invited into a completely different relationship. And so, yeah, we do. When I go home, for example, I usually take off a couple layers. I feel more at home when I'm in my little domicile in Eden Prairie. I feel a little safer. I wear less armor. When I'm with people that I know well, people that I trust, people that I care about, I don't need to wear as much. I periodically take off layers. I can sometimes do it by choice. Sometimes it happens to me. My sister was telling me last night she was doing a really intense workout. She's a rock climber. And she said, you know, when you're pushing your body to a certain point, your ego just falls away. It isn't like a great grand Satori experience necessarily, but she's like, all the normal things about you that you would normally keep in check, you can't anymore because you don't have any fuel left in the tank. So your nose is running and you're sweating and you smell and you're swearing, but you don't care because you're in this kind of really raw place. Oh, right. Voluntarily, all by itself, layers of armor fall away. The other thing that strikes me about this story, and this is just me adding, is it feels as I read this story, like here we have our setup, which is the princess has to marry a dragon, and so we know where this is going to go, and it does in fact go there. But what feels to me like one of the things that changes is the dragon's intention. So again, maybe this is just me, but at the beginning of the story, it's like, I get to marry the princess. You can feel the dragon-y energy there, right? Possession, control, owning, grabbing, taking, greed. We all know this energy, right? Right? Yes. Please, nod. Please acknowledge your dragon. If you don't acknowledge it's there, you're in really big trouble. There's nothing more dangerous than a dragon that doesn't know it's a dragon. My goodness. So yes, I want, I will own, I will possess, I will use, I will take, I will, right? We know that energy. And we know that because he's in transaction with her. You do one, I do one. Oh, fine. I'll give you this, but only in exchange for, right? But as time goes on, and he becomes softer and softer and more and more human, at least in my imagination, by the time these are just two naked human beings, the intention has to be different, or he'd still be a dragon. So what brought him through the door, so to speak, changed. Again, this was relevant for me because I am aware, at least to the degree that I am, how much my intention in this place has changed in the past however many years I've been coming here. When I first walked in the door, the front door was the back door. Remember the back door being the front door? Yeah. 1993, I walked in the back door, and I had lots of dragon energy. And I did not know that I had dragon energy because I imagined I had lamb energy. I mean, come on, I'm going to a Zen center, you guys. Give me props. I'm deep. Right? Oh, sweet thing. So he's a dragon, but doesn't know he's a dragon. Why do I know? Because in retrospect, I remember the energy was grasping, 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 owning, controlling. Of course. It's what brings lots of people in the door. That's a great reason to be in the door, right? They have something that I want. Good. Do that. Go with that for now. It'll change. But my whole idea, the myth that existed in my head about what Zen practice was a drug that makes you high and you never come down. Sounds pretty good. Sounds really good. Do you feel the dragon energy there? Like, oh, I want that. Arr, I'm going to take it back to my cave and guard it. And do you also feel that what I was wanting to do is be more defended? I didn't know what this path was going to do to me, you guys. But I wanted armor that was so good that I was never hurt again. That's why I came. Isn't that a great reason to come? That's a great reason to come. That's why a lot of us come, even if we don't know it. I am hurt. Life is hard. I feel raw and naked out there, and I'm tired of it. I want to go to something, or have something, or own something, or be something that just doesn't hurt anymore. Make it go away. Right? And if that looks like enlightenment, great. I'll take it. I'll take it. That means when the guy's rude to me on the bus, I won't spiral into shame. When mom and dad yell at me, it won't hurt anymore. If a divorce comes, it won't hurt. I'll be okay because I'm enlightened, and enlightened people don't hurt anymore. I want the thickest armor in the universe. That's what motivated me. Arr, do you feel it? I love that place. It's so pregnant with possibility. That amount of pain makes us really pliable, strangely, right? We're really armored up, and yet you can feel the brittleness of it. Can't you? Wow. So my intention really has evolved. It will continue, I very much hope, just the way the dragons does. About two-thirds of the way through the story, we finally see the dragon starting to do something we probably don't expect dragons to do. He is starting to weep. I don't normally associate dragons with weeping. They're usually roaring, fire-breathing animals who don't spend a lot of time weeping. I don't imagine them weeping. He begins to weep, and so now we're starting to see something. So even if that was the first time you've heard this story, when you're listening, you're like, now the dragon's starting to weep. How do I feel about the dragon now? I mean, at the beginning, you know, kind of like, dragon, bad, right? But now you're like, oh, he's crying. It hurts that bad that even a dragon is crying. Oh, my God. You can feel the tenderness, right? Start to go, oh. But he keeps going. And I would argue it's at this point something has to shift in his motivation. If his motivation was just comfort and control, it has to stop here. But something else takes over. Some part of him wants to remember. Some part of him does remember who he actually is. And now the pain becomes, this is what it feels like to wake up. This is what it feels like to go all the way down. Something is entirely different now, that he's crying and weeping but still going. Does that make sense to you? When my teachers were kind enough to send me back down to the Zendo, that's a choice I'm making, right? This is Minneapolis, Minnesota, you guys. I can walk out right now and get in my car and drive away and never come back. It's really easy to do that. And everybody reaches a point in practice where that initial wave starts wearing off. And this isn't like cool and exotic and Japanese anymore. It starts being like just a bunch of people sitting around dealing with their stuff. And the romance goes out and the wind goes out of the sails and it starts being dry or it starts to hurt worse. And you're like, what happened to the thing I was here for originally? And when we do choose to stay, we're staying for a different reason now. Something else entirely. Right? A different kind of wind is in our sails. And honestly, that's what we don't see that much. I'm one of the people like lucky enough to teach the intro class upstairs, right? Anna's teaching intro this morning. I've taught that for many years, like a lot of us have. So I've seen hundreds, thousands. Ben even did the math once. I forget what the number was, the number of people that go through the door to the intro program, and then the percentage of those people that become members, and the percentage of those people who stick around more than 5 years, and it's incredibly small. And that makes perfect sense to me. That's not an institutional failing. That's, no, this starts being hard. Duh. You know, it just starts being hard when you're down to layer number two, layer number three, layer number four, falling away, and the tears start coming. It's pretty easy to do something else than be here. So what motivates us has to change. And so he is described, the dragon is described, as becoming more tender, as his skin is exposed, and his form softens as he becomes lighter and lighter. Well, that's, isn't that great? You're like, oh, enlightenment, man. It's not like enheavenment. Here we go. He's getting lighter. He's getting lighter. He's starting to take it off. You know? You kind of want to talk to him, don't you? Like, oh, it hurts way worse. You're like, no, but you're doing it right. This is the thing. I know it hurts worse, but God, don't quit, man. This is the deal. You're so close. Can you feel it? Like, you feeling more means you're doing it right. That means you're doing it right. You're here to become more human, not more dragon. You're here to become covered in nothing, as opposed to bulletproof. It's the opposite of what you thought. You're insanely vulnerable all of the time to joy and to the breeze and to the kid and to the traffic and to all of it. It comes in and it goes out because you're free. He's getting lighter and lighter. Oh, that's just my favorite part, you know? You're just like, ooh, it's the end of Act 2, and he's getting close, he's getting lighter and lighter, he's crying ferociously, and it's very dramatic. You're like, oh my God, keep going, keep going. Oh, you're so close. Oh. He is finally described as having eyes that sparkle like a child. Ah, it's right there, isn't it? His eyes sparkle like a child. Of course they do. In all of our traditions, Zen especially loves to do with this, the fool, the archetype of the playful fool, the nun, the monk, the master who is so awake that they, you know, they're just awake now. They don't have the layers of ego armoring that keep us sitting up straight and being strict and saying things in iambic pentameter. They're just playing now. It's all they've seen through the fiction, and they play. They've got eyes like a child. Of course they have eyes like a child. It's not like those eyes ever went away. They're right there in your head. So of course his eyes sparkle, and he's released at last from the ancient spell. So Suzuki Roshi, in our tradition, said the only way you can endure your pain... I know how bad you want me to finish that sentence. The only way you can endure your pain is to let it be painful. That's the secret. That's the secret sauce. Stop fighting it. Let it hurt. Let it be painful. Don't argue it away. Don't distance yourself from it. Don't explain it away. Don't add judgment. Don't add interpretation. Let it be painful. When you allow something to be painful, you are choosing to relate to pain with kindness. That's what we do here. That's what this path is about. To slowly but surely begin to realize, I am and always have been the princess. I am and always have been this person who's put under an ancient spell. And is it my fault? No. Is it my responsibility? Yes. So you own it. And with great kindness and with great tenderness and with great patience, we work and we work and we work. And the good news is, because this is the Bodhisattva path and it is infinite, the good news is there are not only 10 layers, you guys. There's a whole bunch more layers than that, but it's okay. Don't worry about counting them. And they grow back, but don't worry about that. Don't get attached to the end, because the part of you that's doing the work is the part of you that's doing the work. If there wasn't a prince inside, do you get it? It's the prince that's doing all of the work. We're already that. Okay. I think that's as much as I've got for you today. I hope this is helpful. I love it, and I love it probably, you guys, because the times when this story speaks the most deeply to me are the times when it's very hard. And I need to be reminded that very hard doesn't mean doing it wrong. That oftentimes very hard means doing it right. And I need to be reminded of the bravery and the kindness that's possible when we choose to unite with who we really are, when we choose to uncover the truth of who we really are. And so I think that's part of why this speaks to me so deeply. And I thank you for your attention. Does anybody have anything they would like to throw into the room, comments or questions about dragons in general or St. George in particular or any experiences wearing 10 nightgowns at once? Anything? Okay. Carrie?
My youngest son attended Minnesota Waldorf School. Mm. In the Waldorf tradition, Rudolf Steiner was the creator of Waldorf, if you know about it all. There's a lot of things. They pull in a lot of, because he was from, like, German, Austrian descent. There's all of the Scandinavian, a lot of Scandinavian myths and things that they use.
Oh.
They go by quarter years. And they celebrate St. George and the Dragon with a beautiful play that that's done outside, and the dragon, they have a long, like, kind of like Chinese kind of style.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the kids are under it.
Oh!
And somebody's St. George, and somebody's a princess, and yeah, your experience of feeling, you know, compassion for that dragon was the same experience that I've had every single time I've seen this play, right? The kids do the play. The dragon, yes, symbolizes this, like, oh, we're going to get it. And feel so bad with the dragon that the dragon goes down. And you know, one by one, the kids collapse the dragon underneath. So it reminded me of that, and how to actually ask my youngest son how he feels about that. Like, what's his experience knowing this story, right? And having that. At one time, he was St. George.
So he got to play both. See, this whole integration thing would be way easier for him, right? Like, because he's played all of the different... That's so sweet. How do you slay a dragon, mean to kids? I mean, come on, man. Like, it'd be like, no, we've got punch and cookies, sweet dragon. That's very dear.
You know, to use those stories, right, as you're growing up, and to kind of live and breathe them, and they use them in multiple ways throughout the curriculum from first grade to eighth grade.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think it's a cool thing.
I'm envious. I love how receptive we are at a young age to fairy tale and myth and metaphor. You know, it just goes right in, doesn't it? It makes so much sense to us at that age.
Your memories made me think of a memory when I was probably between 5 and 7. I remember being very angry that I was born.
Wow.
That I was given no choice because I would have to die.
Wow.
Became really, I mean, I would cry. I would find my mom. I would need to find my mom specifically because I had this very was unfair, like so unfair that I'm going to, you brought me here. I didn't have a choice, and now I'm going to have to die.
Wow, you are a Buddhist right out of the gate. That is, you were just destined. That's so brilliant because of the mishaps of your parents. You're in good company. Thank you all so much for your attention today, John. I will turn this show over to you, my friend.